Welcome to the Breezy Breakfast Municipal Digest, where every bite is a nutritious, energizing spoonful of food for thought. Today we're joined by Upper Grand District School Board Chair Ralph Mezenbrink, who speaks on current issues facing the Board of Education. Whether it's regarding the budget, library offerings, or support for students with extra learning needs and challenges, local boards are often expected to provide solutions to every problem. Sometimes it's the province that makes the rules and establishes the budget for textbooks and other school supplies. We're also joined by first-year counselor Aaron Caton. Aaron discusses what her first year was like. As a passionate advocate for accessibility, Aaron has transformed herself from the active citizen to engaged counselor. Aaron and Phil engage in a lively discourse on budget, transit, parks, and most importantly, the big unknown, how does one build a thriving community of the future when the rules change almost daily?
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another Breezy Breakfast in beautiful downtown Guelph at Rise and Shine Restaurant with Bev, our erstwhile and loyal supporter who takes our orders and keeps us in line. Today's Breezy Breakfast is a buffet. We have Ralph Mezenbrink, Chair of the Board of Education and a first-year trustee with us to speak about educational issues. Something that I apologize we don't do enough of. We also have Aaron Caton, who will be joining us later, to speak about her experiences as a first-year counselor, some of her gains, some of her disappointments, and some of her hopes for the future. With that, I am going to, first of all, begin with our territorial acknowledgement, and please join with me as we think seriously about our relationship with the land and with the Indigenous people who have been here before us. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and the generations to come. If our actions today can move us towards reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. This place we call Guelph has served as traditional lands and a place of refuge for many people over time. But more specifically, the Adirondack and the Haudenosaunee. This land is held as treaty lands and territory with the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation. Guelph lies directly adjacent to the Haldimand Tract and is part of the long-established traditional hunting ground for the Six Nations of the Grand River. Many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people who have come from across Turtle Island call Guelph home today. And with that, welcome to Breezy Breakfast. I would like to acknowledge that the opinions expressed here are not the opinions of either the Rise and Shine Restaurant or CFRU, or more particularly, anyone other than the speaker. We welcome freedom of speech, and we also welcome civility at all times. And with that, I'm going to turn my attention to Ralph Mezenbrink, who is the chair of the Board of Education. Ralph, after a long career as an educator, literally got his arm twisted into running for the Board of Education by his wife, former chair, Linda Busatil, who is now a counselor. And I brought Ralph here, hopefully so that he could speak on the B's, budgets, boundaries, and educational boondoggles. We don't hear enough about education. And let's face it, education is a big part of our life in Ontario. We pay for and pay doctors, lawyers, electricians, everyone who provides us with a good life in Ontario, and more. And so with that, Ralph, I'd like to welcome you here. And I guess the first question I'd like to ask you is, how has your first year been?
Thank you, Phil. It's been a wonderful learning experience for me. I did spend 35 years in education, so I understand that's part of the role. That's only part of the role. A lot of learning on governance and the separation between governance and operational issues, as well as something that I don't like very much, which is, let's call it, small P politics. There are memos we get from the Ministry of Education. I do see a number of concerns raised by parents and so on that come my way. So I find that very interesting and very fulfilling to help solve some problems. Some problems are easy to solve and others take time.
Great. Thank you very much. So you mentioned governance and you mentioned operations as well. And I think many people believe that the trustees that they elect have a firsthand role in the operations. Personally, it's my understanding from having been an educator as well, that the trustees provide a foundation for policy, but the real movers and shakers are the administration and the staff.
That's correct, Phil. We do have a couple of responsibilities that the Ministry of Education or the Education Act gives us. We are responsible for budgets. We're responsible for hiring our one employee, and that is the Director of Education, who then theoretically hires everybody else. And each trustee has absolutely no individual authority. We only have authority as a board after we've passed a motion. And you're correct. Policies are our lane, so to speak. And from those policies, then staff produce procedures that then operationalize those policies. So we work up in the stratosphere, so to speak, and it is our staff who then implement those directions from us.
So then if, say, a parent had a concern about something, would they go to you or would they go to staff? How does the relationship with those in the classroom and those running the Board of Education work in comparison, say, to a trustee?
Thank you, Phil. We do have a very comprehensive, at least I think very comprehensive policy, our public concerns policy. If it is a school issue, we would expect that a parent starts with the principal or the teacher, actually. And if there's no resolution there, move on to the principal. And there are a number of different steps, school superintendent, the executive superintendent, director of education. But for school-based educational type issues, those are really to be solved by staff. Now, as a trustee, I do have a role. We all have a role. And for the most part, that role is helping parents to navigate that process, to help them determine who they should be speaking to and so on. But we don't advocate for individual parents. That's not our role. If we see something that might be a policy issue, that might end up as a change in policy at some point to solve an issue that may involve a number of different parents.
Great. Now we've done the lobs. I wanted to just warm us up, just like a nice light massage before we actually get into it. I really want to ask a couple of hard questions now. And one of them revolves around something that I think you and I and many other educators are familiar with. And that is the term in loco parentis, which essentially means while you are with me, I am your parent. And I've always been concerned about that one, and more particularly concerned now, as many parents argue that their rights are being trampled as parents, that they have rights over their children, and that even teachers and even the school system does not have those rights. I've always seen it as responsibilities. I was wondering if you could talk perhaps about the enormous responsibility that educators have for children when they are in their care, and why that reinforces the notion that parents have responsibilities, not rights over their kids.
Thank you. That's a loaded question. I think that about a month ago, when Alicia Ralph was here from our board, our human rights and equity advisor, she answered that question very well. Educators have responsibilities to ensure that students are safe, responsibility to create the best learning environment possible for our students. However, in terms of parental rights, as Alicia pointed out, students have human rights, and parental responsibilities don't override those human rights. The term used in loco parentis, I think, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that it's about the responsibility that we are expected to take the same care in terms of taking care of a child as a parent would, and does not talk about rights or overriding rights of a child by a parent or by an educator, for that matter.
And in fact, actually, I believe that the Education Act contains the phrase, a teacher must act as a, quote, kind, judicious parent. And I think that that's something perhaps we should all take to heart. I'll come back to this later on, but I want to get to a couple of other issues. And Rolf, I probably will ask you a little bit about this new trope that's been floated by the Ministry of Education about Holocaust education. Holocaust education has always existed, as far as I know, and I'm surprised it's now being advocated again when it's already been there. But let's deal with budget. What is the role and what are the responsibilities of trustees for budget, and how does that then fall to the local taxpayers, or does it?
Thank you, Phil. Until, I believe it was 1997, trustees did have control over the local tax rate, the mill rate, the education portion of your property taxes. That was changed in order to provide more equitable funding across the province back in, I believe, 1996 or 97. The education portion of taxes now goes towards or goes to the Ministry of Education, which then doles out an appropriate amount for every school board across the province. And that helps eliminate areas that have, let's call it a rich property tax base versus areas that don't. Our school board budget, which is, I don't know the number off the top, but it's somewhere north of $400 million. The vast majority of that is allocated towards collective agreements and personnel. Bottom line is we don't have an awful lot of wiggle room within that. This year, in June, the Board of Trustees passed a budget that included taking roughly 1.5%, about $6 million from an accumulated surplus and using it to help support literacy and numeracy learning for our youngest students to try and close some of the gaps that we know exist. That existed pre-pandemic, but were exacerbated by the pandemic. This is a short-term piece, and it is in addition to funding for literacy and numeracy that the province already has in place for every school board that has paid for or is paying for extra resources, support teachers, training, a number of other things. And we hope that in the next couple of months and longer, we will start to see results from that investment.
Great. And at that point, you mentioned supply teachers and you mentioned teachers going into the classroom when someone is away. I understand that right across Ontario, there's been a real shortage of supply teachers, and also that this has had a significant impact on the budget of boards of education. If you could, I'd love to hear your perspective on that and give us some details on why the supply teacher budget and why the shortage of supply teachers is both urgent and how this came about. 10 years ago, you could get a supply teacher. You could find them in every corner of the province looking for work, and now we don't seem to be able to find them at all. And I'm just wondering, what the heck happened?
I don't have a good answer for you as to what the heck happened. I do know that we do have an issue with supply, and I'll say supply staff in general. It is not just teachers. It is also our educational assistants. It is our office assistants. It is throughout the system. When people are absent, trying to find people to replace has become more difficult than it was in the past. I don't know what the cause of this is. I don't know whether the change, I'm not sure how long ago it was, 10 or 12 years ago, from a one-year teacher's college program to a two-year program had any kind of impact. When I talk to people, and this is only my own opinion, I'm not sure that teaching, as an example, is as attractive an occupation. Or when I started, it was a vocation, it was a calling, at least for me. And I'm just wondering whether that is no longer necessarily the case. And as for the job itself has changed. I know that there's been an increase in violence in the classroom. Certainly the number of students with special needs makes the job much more difficult. I'll leave it at that.
If you can, I'm going to push you a bit on both of those. Violence. What is our local experience with violence? That certainly is of concern. I've heard of it in places like Toronto and larger centers, but violence in Guelph is perhaps something that most people aren't aware of. And then you mentioned special needs as well. Are we talking about gangs in the schools? Are we talking about students acting out? What is it that we're talking about when it comes to violence?
I have not heard much about any kind of local issues. I can't answer about gangs in schools or anything. I'm not aware of anything. I do know that from my experience in another board as an educator, that there are students who will act out, and some staff have to wear personal protective equipment because of the students that they're working with. That is not something that I saw 35 years ago. I'm not exactly sure what has changed, if anything. I know that at the time, there were probably students we have in our system now that would have been in institutions. And certainly that is one change. I am an advocate for inclusion. But beyond that, we have not seen the kinds of violence that we hear about in the press from other centers like Toronto, but that's all I can say right now.
Oh, no, that's great. What I understand is just my own personal perspective is that you mentioned personal protective equipment, and that covers a very broad range of things. But I understand that some support workers are often quite literally covered in personal protective equipment because of acting out that is not deliberate. It just happens to be a consequence of something that is developmentally related. And I want to get to that as well. We talked about the challenges and the needs to incorporate students with different educational needs within the system. How has that changed? What are we talking about when we mean that we incorporate students into the system and that we provide accommodations for them and are mindful that not all students are the same?
Trying to think of a good response there. I have seen a change over the past almost 40 years now in education. Certainly during the first 20 years or so of that, I didn't pay close attention to the system level changes. I was a high school math and physics teacher and dealt with mostly academic issues. Certainly when I started teaching, I don't recall ever seeing an IEP for the first few years. Maybe that was my naivete, call it that. But certainly things have changed in the past in terms of requirements to make sure that all our students have the supports they need to be as successful as they can be. And that means that there are accommodations for students, whether that be things like text-to-speech, whether that be things like sitting at the front of the classroom, and it goes on from there to more intensive accommodations. But realistically, what we want is for every student to have the same or to have the best outcomes possible for them. And that means that different students will need different levels of support.
Now, I've heard from some educators that one of the challenges with the duty to accommodate is not the accommodation per se, but is actually the budget and the size of classes. Are we seeing a challenge with class size leading to us experiencing challenges with the duty to accommodate?
On a system level, I'll have difficulty answering that question. I think if you talk to individual teachers, they will give you a response. Class sizes have not changed much in the past several years. The duty to accommodate and so on has not changed drastically over the last probably at least 10 years, if not longer. So can't answer more than that right now.
That's fine. And just for people that are listening, I do appreciate that in some cases, Rolf will be constrained from answering questions because there are issues of a confidential nature that make it somewhat challenging for Rolf. just a couple of other questions, and then I want to get to some questions from that we know that we already have. But Ralph, I understand that there are boundary changes that are often occurring within the school system. Are we aware of any boundary changes that perhaps might bring concern to people? I'd heard that, for example, Central school boundaries are changing, and Central's always in the process of being redeveloped in some way, shape, or form. There might be other schools as well. How does that work? And should the public and parents be concerned about these things?
Thank you. So I'm going to have to take a step back for a moment and talk about every board is required to have a long-term accommodation plan. And that is a plan that takes into account future growth. And by future growth, I mean growth that is expected and probably not acted upon until there are approvals in place or perhaps even building permits. But we plan to, as a system, we plan to take a look at the number of students in each school and compare that to the capacity of the school. That long-term accommodation plan, I believe, is renewed completely every 5 years, and predicts our current one predicts 3 and 8 years out. It is updated every year. And when the draft plan came to us in June, it was clear that we have some schools that are very well utilized. We have some that are overutilized. We have some that are underutilized. Funding for new schools depends on a business case, which depends on the number of students we actually have and does not really take into account the fact that there might be 1,000 new homes being built in that area. The current funding model for the province to fund schools depends on the number of students we actually have, as well as the number of spaces we have in the area. As a result of that, on, I believe, October 17th, to our Finance and Facilities Committee, a report came forward that recommended starting a boundary review for two of our schools, Central Public School here in town and Primrose Public School in Dufferin County. That report will come to our board meeting on November the 14th. And if the board chooses to move ahead and accept that report, then we will start a formal boundary review. I have had some questions from public as to why we start with options and why aren't parents given an opportunity to provide input. My understanding is that there is a provincial requirement. I have found the actual document for pupil accommodation reviews, have been on the shelf for a number of years. And that is when a board decides to close a school that is no longer viable. What has to happen is a report has to come forward with options to the trustees to start that process. And I believe we use exactly the same process to start a boundary review. It has to be a report that provides data, including recent enrollment trends, what our long-term accommodation plan, our draft long-term accommodation plan predicts will be the enrollment for the future, and then provides some options to start the discussion. If that is approved on November the 14th, then we'll start a process that is laid out. The board has a website for each of those potential boundary reviews up and running. There's also a survey up and running. And there are multiple opportunities for parents to provide input, either directly through their local trustee or through in each school. There will be a public information session being held at the school. I believe Central's is on November 30th, I believe, but please check the website. And then there are opportunities to delegate both to committee as well as to the board. And hopefully a final decision made in February so that changes can be implemented for the next school year. As you know, there's staffing and other things that have to happen in the meantime.
Right. And the last point that I want to return to is about Holocaust education. Personally, I believe Holocaust education is tremendously important. And I was surprised when the ministry floated that Holocaust education was going to be mandatory, because it already is. It's part of the grade 9 or 10 history program, and is also included within the civics program as well as part of civil and human rights. Ralph, how much responsibility does a local board have for determining such things as Holocaust education, or even something like whether we teach creationism or evolution within a school?
My answer to that would be, as a former educator, is we have zero control over that. Curriculum is set by the province. And every publicly funded school in the Ontario publicly funded education system has to follow the same curriculum. Going back to Holocaust education, certainly that is critically important. I believe that anti-Black racism, anti-Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism are actually mentioned in the Education Act, although I'll have to double-check that. So certainly it is there. I did read the memo that came out after the announcement, I believe, earlier this week. And a lot of the memo was about new resources being provided to support Holocaust education, as well as some potential changes to the grade 10 history curriculum, which is a history of Canada. I apologize. I was not a history teacher, so I'm not that familiar with the current curriculum.
Tanya, I believe you have a couple of questions in the chat for Ralph. And then I know that we have one within the restaurant. Interestingly, just a plug for the restaurant, we have a very healthy crowd down here, and it keeps getting healthier every week. So come on down.
What are your thoughts on school boards, per direction of the Ministry of Education, restricting what students can read? Do trustees at the Upper Grand have any role in this process? An example that was given, were you aware that in 2021, all school librarians in the Upper Grand were asked to remove the book To Kill a Mockingbird from their shelves and classrooms?
I was not aware of that. I became a trustee in October of 2022. I'm not aware of trustees being involved in decisions around individual books. Certainly in terms of policies, we have policies to make sure that there are resources in place so that all our students see themselves reflected somehow in the resources that are there. And I imagine that our librarians have a process to follow to ensure that the books that are available are appropriate and provide an equitable and so that there's a wide variety of resources so that every student can find something that reflects their life circumstances and themselves.
So I guess given what I've heard, what you've said previously, is it correct for me to say that the Ministry of Education has directed school boards to remove To Kill a Mockingbird? And as school trustees, you do not have a role in that directive?
I don't know. I can't answer that question. I'm not aware of the ministry during the time I've been a trustee directing any particular books by title. My understanding is that any direction is a direction to make sure that there's a wide variety of resources so that every child can see themselves reflected in the resources available in the school. As I said, individual titles don't come to us as a school board.
Tanya, does that help?
Not really, but it's okay. The next question is, the effect of the no keeping kids back, which is to say in elementary school, kids are not failed because it is considered a social nightmare for children. But this policy becomes very clear when these kids enter high school. Does the Upper Grand School Board have any say in that? And would they ever reconsider this policy?
I have to admit, I don't know enough about that to provide a good answer for you. Some of these things would be school-based decisions that take into account the social growth as well as the academic growth of the student. My experience as an educator was in high school, where it's very clear that students did fail. That's the best I can provide for you right now. Thank you.
Okay, I understand. The last is a follow-up on the challenge of accommodation of students. How is it possible to provide optimal learning environments in a classroom full of kids with different abilities?
I'll say it's challenging, and I'll leave it at that.
Fair enough. And with that, I'm going to pass the mic over to Glenn.
As a person with without children, I was wondering when I heard about the announcement on Holocaust teaching, I was wondering if you could enlighten me. I've been really out of touch with the education system, and I have no idea about Indigenous studies, culture and history. Is there a robust curriculum in our school systems now for Indigenous teaching?
You know, actually, I'm going to try to answer that one first. And the reason for that is years ago, when I was still a teacher, the Indigenous Studies courses were introduced at high school. This is a singular course that's offered at the grade 11 level. My gut instinct is that while we did pay some attention to Indigenous Studies, prior to that, it was extremely limited. Now, there is the one course that intends not to replace what is taught throughout the curriculum from kindergarten onward, but to enhance it. How well that works, I can't say, but that course is not mandatory either. And the real challenge is to encourage both Indigenous and non-Indigenous students to see value in that course. And regrettably, I would have to say that in some cases, some students don't see value in that. And that's unfortunate. Ralph, do you want to comment?
Again, I've been out of the education system, or at least out of a school for a number of years, so I have not kept up with all the changes to curriculum. I will say that on a couple of school visits, I have been impressed at the number of students and their enthusiasm for the Indigenous Studies course, the grade 11 course. I attended an event at John F. Ross, as example, in the spring, and the students in that course were very active in that event and very proud of their heritage and shared a fair bit about what they had learned in the course. I think we are getting better at it, but we can always do better as a system. And by system, I don't just mean Upper Grand, I mean the Ontario publicly funded system.
I had a question that came in from the chat, and I think it's perhaps more to me than it is to Rome. Says, Phil, you said you spent an inordinate amount of time on Holocaust issues. This basically means disproportionate or excessive? I think that's a very good question, and my answer would be no, I don't think it's excessive. What I did was I placed Holocaust education personally within the context of an understanding of civil and human rights and how significant the need to protect both civil and human rights is, not just in Canada, but worldwide. Not only did we focus on the Holocaust, we focused on other issues such as the Rwanda genocide and the Armenian massacre and issues like that as well. The thing about the Holocaust is because of the atrocity of the Holocaust, the Holocaust is in so many ways central to the understanding of human rights and the protection of them worldwide. I will give Canada a lot of credit for establishing the Museum of Human Rights in Winnipeg. I think that we need to continue to do work on Holocaust education and to raise awareness that civil and human rights, regardless whom it is that you are, need to be protected, and that there is a very important role to play in developing our understanding of how pervasive still in many quarters is anti-Semitism, but not just anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, concerns about homophobia, concerns about the repression of not just human rights, but actual the use of physical violence against individuals purely because of their faith, their culture, or their sexual orientation or other concerns as well. And I hope that clarifies the issue for anybody out there who's wondering whether we spend a lot of time on this. The sad thing about being a history teacher was I was once told by a friend of mine jokingly, you got the easiest job in the world.
all you have to do is add on another year of current events. That was, of course, never the case. History is about teaching critical education and understanding. Yes, we have Morgan with a question.
This one's for Ralph. So you talk about the boards being able to enact policy. And we just had a question about the level of Indigenous teaching within the school system at the moment. One of the things that Breezy Breakfast has highlighted in the past is an incredible project that is called the Moccasin Identifier Project, whereby there are educational materials that have been developed specifically for each grade level, starting in kindergarten with just what is a friend, what is being kind, and those kinds of ideas. So I'm wondering if there is a place for the board to start some sort of an investigation into having Moccasin Identifier Project be the lead Indigenous teaching, at least for Upper Grand District School Board, most specifically because the person that started this is a person who is part of the Mississaugas of the First Nation of Mississaugas of New Credit. So just wondering if there's a role for our school board to bring that in for our students, at least.
In terms of the board as a whole, and I'll move away from Board of Trustees for a moment, probably the best way to bring this forward is we do have a First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Education Council. That includes, I believe, community members as well as staff members. And that might be a place to raise the Moccasin Identifier materials. I can make a connection, and then they can bring forward a recommendation if they wish to the board. That's probably the best way forward.
Thank you.
And with that, Ralph, I want to thank you. Ralph had said that he could probably stay and answer for about 20 minutes, and he thought that that would probably be the limit. But Ralph, I got to say, it's now 45 minutes later, and I think that you've informed us quite well about some of the issues associated with education and some of the challenges going forward. We know there are others. We know that there's a new high school planned, and this will be front and center, and that there are school closures possibly that can occur. We know that there are always issues with curriculum and challenges. And Rolf, as a first-year trustee who was then elected to the chair of the Board of Education, I want to thank you very much for getting up to speed on an awful lot of issues and still having an appreciation for things like physics and how we teach our kids to split the atom in a grade 12 physics class. So thanks very much, Ralph. And with that, I'm going to switch it over. It's now city time, and we finally have with us Councillor Aaron Caton, a first-year councillor. And I'm going to start this off, Aaron, by just framing this. Aaron's tenure as a city councillor, which has just been a year, we have seen tremendous changes occurring. We have seen the challenges that we have faced as a consequence of changes in development procedures and development regulations. We have seen areas of the Greenbelt in Ontario being carved out. We have been introduced to the idea of strong mayor powers. All of these things came in before Erin was a city councillor, and I believe it was foisted on her about 1 week after she was elected as perhaps the gift that keeps on giving from Premier Ford. I know that we have a number of questions here about city budget and about other concerns, but Erin, I just first of all want to hear from you. How has your first year been?
It has been very enthralling and busy. I think that the idea that this is a part-time job is incorrect, at least if you're kind of going through all of the changes that we have been. It feels a little bit like you're trying to make policy and process while you're riding on a yo-yo, because a lot of things keep on getting foisted on us, and then you find out that they've been done improperly, potentially even fraudulently, and now they're being reversed. So it makes it a little bit difficult to try to make a plan for the city when you are dealing with provincial structure that is constantly in flux. But otherwise, I actually really, really enjoy it. I have really had fun in the parts of the job that include helping people. I actually do think that I've got to help quite a lot of people this last year. And in pure project manager fashion, I made a list. So I was really happy that some of the things that I went around and talked to people about at the door actually got completed in my first year. And I wasn't necessarily expecting that to happen, especially with a lot of the development and provincial chaos. But it may not seem like a big deal to a lot of people, but having the driveways widened a little bit in the townhouses so that people can actually be off the street in the winter and not get as many tickets is a big win for affordability for a lot of people in my ward, because we don't have a lot of bus service that comes along the edges. So that was a big win for me. And while it didn't get passed through, I recently, actually on the 1 year anniversary of being a counselor, or being elected rather, I got to put forward 5 motions towards playground accessibility to try to make our rubber services more equitable and have a plan to have them more distributed throughout the city and have some play options along the edges of the areas that have wood chips. Because just like with the development issues, we are subject to provincial legislation that claims certain things are accessible when they're really not. So there's a lot of fun things that kind of went well. If you think process is fun, then there are fun things to go through this year. And that one got pushed onto the Accessibility Advisory Council to review and to work with staff to implement, and the things that had budget impact will be brought back to council to vote on later. But having been on the AAC for over a year, I'm fairly confident that the things that are within their purview will be implemented as much as they can be before we have to do budget approvals.
I just want to unpack some of the accessibility issues that you related. I think this is important, and I know you're the kind of no-holds-barred counselor that I appreciate being on council, and you speak quite frankly. It's interesting that issues of accessibility have not been taken up that strongly in the past. Why is this important to you, and why in particular do you believe it's important to address issues of accessibility in parks and on playgrounds?
Well, I think that there haven't been that many openly disabled counselors, and I have a disability collection. I seem to get a new one every year. So I think I have a different perspective being a part of the disability community and being actively involved in disability justice issues prior to being a counselor. So our population is rising, and we've got a very large amount of boomers who are just entering the retirement market, and disability and age-friendly living is kind of a hand-in-hand situation. So I think that it's really important to design things for people who actually exist in the world rather than what we would hope is an ideal body and ability. Everybody has the same needs overall, but people who have disabilities can only access a fraction of the services. So when you think about equity, and one of the things we did this last year was we redid our strategic plan. And prior to my being on council, equity was only added in the last version. So that's fairly new. And I think that as we kind of move through just society's evolution, that human rights and equity are having a bigger lens than they used to, right? So parks is very important piece of the equity, because especially since COVID, being outside and being able to socialize with fresh air is very, very important, more important than we even knew. So being able to access those spaces whether you walk, use a wheelchair or a cane or any other mobility device, it shouldn't be something that you have to question. You shouldn't have to plan your day out based around what exists near your house. We have a policy where parks should be within 500 to 800 meters of most people's walking distance. And recently with the new Parks and Rec plan, which is an improvement, we have it listed that it's 2.5 kilometers between rubber service parks. So that's a quite significant distance. And we're expecting people who have less capability for mobility to travel much further to be able to have the same quality of life. So that doesn't really seem fair to me. And I would really like it so that everybody has the same quality of life in Guelph and that we're all able to enjoy our spaces.
Okay, well, let's just unpack that a bit. I think that everybody's aware that the difference between equity and equality is substantial, and we're talking equity here. But what I am aware about you is that you want improvement. Now, what I'm not certain that others are aware of is that, and I'm going to let you answer, do you want them now, or are you looking at this from a logical, sequential, progressive fashion when we can afford it?
Well, I want them now. Whether or not I think it's feasible to have them now is it's a totally separate issue. It's harder to manage a budget and then manage equity at the same time. So you kind of have to do both at the same time. And I know that change management is a big passion of mine as well, because you can't ask for the world and expect it to happen when you don't have the money to pay for it. So what I want is a progressive policy. And that's the type of thing that my motions were including. I want to make sure that we're moving forward and we're making incremental change so that we're not just static and saying, you know, this is good enough when we know it's not.
Let's just deal with change management for a bit, because I think that's a really good way to put this. I think that as members of council, you are in the business of change management. There are two significant projects that just got approved, neither of which is for your ward. So I want to hear your perspective on this. We have a library and a South End Recreation Center, both of which have been approved in a challenging year for budget. Why do those matter to you?
Well, the library, first off, is quite close to my ward compared to the library that currently exists that has the technology improvements. So the library downtown is going to have a makerspace. And this is a huge thing for not only adults who want to go in and figure out new technology, but kids. And in my ward, there isn't a lot of options for kids, especially teenagers. And this space is going to be a much closer location that is along major transit routes, because everything goes through downtown, to go and play games, to meet up with friends, to learn how to use tools that will help them learn to either create things just for joy or to become makers and entrepreneurs. And I think that that's a big deal. So access throughout the city, just because it's not in your ward, doesn't mean that people in your ward aren't going to use it. So the library, I think, is a huge piece of that. And it adds a lot for affordability for families who really need to have access to these spaces that people who are more privileged in finances can go to private institutes and learn how to use these tools or buy them for their own homes.
What's South End Rec Center?
For the South End Rec Center, as someone who is personally not at all into sporty anything, I think that activities are important, right? And when you're a counselor, it's not just about you and what you like to do and your pet projects. It's about doing what's best for everyone. And when we create spaces in other wards, that means that it frees up spaces that other people have to go to because they don't have anything near them. So this will allow for more swim classes. I know that I hear from a lot of parents that it's really hard for them to sign up their kids for classes for spaces. And this is going to be another location where it's going to spread the load out throughout the city. So you have to think of things more holistically because we're making decisions for the entirety of Guelph and not just our wards.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you say is, even though you're not going to be playing for the new women's hockey team in Toronto anytime soon, and even though sports aren't really part of your heart and soul per se, that's immaterial. You're making decisions for what is the best for Guelph.
Yeah, and you know, these locations aren't just used for sports too. Like, we have meeting spaces. Some of the locations have community food centers and support groups and things. So there's more stuff that goes on in a recreation center than just sports.
Okay, so now let's get to the ugly truth of the matter. We talked about change management. Now we're going to get the budget management and change in our political currents. Aaron, this is going to be a challenging budget for both you and me. I've talked to you a little bit about this, but I don't think we really got down and dirty about what this particular budget process means to you. Any thoughts about what we are going to be experiencing in the next month? Because I know that I feel quite confused by what it is we're supposed to be doing.
I am also confused because when I ran for council, I was under the impression that you got to vote. And it seems that that part of the budget has been taken away. So now it is by legislation, not by choice of our personal mayor, the mayor's budget. And when it is tabled, my understanding is that it is passed. And then basically you can disapprove of the budget is more the tone. And that doesn't really sit well with me because I'm a single parent and I'm trying to manage a mortgage in the same situation that everybody else is. And we have been forced by the province to remove some of our funding that helps us pay for the development that has been mandated on us and is now a contingent part of getting other provincial funding. And we haven't even been told what that funding is or when it would happen or how much it might be. So it's kind of like having to plan with a lot of caveats. And that doesn't make me very comfortable as a project manager. It makes me feel very nervous about the outcome. But I am hopeful that we can do what we can to kind of massage different portions of it into place. But it's hard to know without all of your footing. You're basically just jumping from rock to rock and hoping you don't slip in the pond at this point. But that's what it feels like. It feels like you're very on a very slippery slope.
Yeah. Okay. And I appreciate that frame because what I heard you say is that when the budget is tabled, it is deemed passed. And then it requires 2/3 of city council to overturn it. Is that your understanding? Because that's my understanding.
Yes. So that's the same thing with the mayoral veto. Because it is technically the mayor's budget, then we would require a 2/3 to counter it.
So not very democratic, is it?
No.
Aaron, let's get down to some real meat and potatoes issues. When I did a calculation, I calculated that about 5% of our potential increase this year will come from the province, quote, not making us whole with regards to our deficiencies in development charges, but rather putting us into a bit of a hole. I'll be perfectly honest, and I believe that if there is a budget that is put forward by a council that is positive for the city but requires us to increase taxes, that I would support that. I'm having real problems with the idea that I might have to pass a budget, or at least be responsible for a budget, where fully 50% or 40% of that budget is a consequence of the province downloading to us more costs. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I'm not opposed to taxes and tax increases if they're going for the common good. And that's how I feel about the library. That's how I feel about the sports center. That's how I feel about accessibility improvements and street safety and speed cameras and Vision Zero and everything else that we try to do. And it's exactly what you said about the extra portion where we're making up for a shortfall created by the province for things that don't necessarily benefit everybody. I am very happy about development discounts for things like truly affordable housing and rent geared to income. Those are things I actually campaigned on as potential ideas to help increase affordable housing stock. But it is too wide of a brush that's being painted in terms of the development discounts at this point. So we're not necessarily going to be getting affordable housing for the type of discounts that we're giving. And that really makes me uncomfortable.
Okay, sure. Fair enough. I actually had to scratch my head when I heard the provincial government talk about giving discounts on HST for rental housing being constructed, because that particular model doesn't really add a whole lot of value to rental housing and thereby reduce costs. But the important point here is that what we as a city council are being asked to do is assume both development charges and also the possibility that developers themselves will assume 100% responsibility for putting in the services. And this comes out of the 7,000 pages that were just released 2 days ago. Developers spoke directly to the I'll just say the ministry and the government, leave any names out of it, saying that they wanted control over the infrastructure that was put in to a future development, and they would front load that. I have some real concerns about that because I am not certain exactly what conditions we have put on that would ensure that that particular infrastructure was put in a way that was forward-minded. Aaron, any comments about this downloading of development charges in particular to taxpayers?
I think that we all have a responsibility to each other for different community pieces, but I don't think that luxury condos are a part of that piece. I think that we really need to be cautious in how much we're subsidizing businesses that are not having any financial issues. And that's what it feels like we're doing. It doesn't make housing happen faster. It doesn't make better housing stock exist. It just helps development and their profits. So unless there are more fail safes and actual regulations in there, then I'm not really supportive of that.
I'm just going to quickly go to see if you have any other concerns, any dreams that you would like to see fulfilled in the next 3 years of your term as council, and any cautions or caveats that you might want to add for what people might expect over the next 3 years.
I think moving towards a more safe, active transportation model where we have bike lanes that are not just kind of out in the road with a line of paint between you and cars will do a lot for our costs and our environment. And I think that that's something that we really need to be working towards. I really am excited about the pedestrian master plan that staff are creating, where we are going to be outlining where there are gaps in sidewalks and in pedestrian crosswalks. I think that the ability to safely cross the street is something that is highly undervalued. And I know this is an issue throughout the whole city, but we got 3 new pedestrian crosswalks in Ward 1 this year. And we've got another one that's going to be built up at the top of Victoria Road. And I'm very, very excited about those. And I basically want more of those throughout the city. And the ability to pay for those instead of paying for developments would be really, really nice, I think, in terms of my wish list. And then transit. We've got a lot to go on terms of the, I'm trying to find a diplomatic way of saying this, the straightforwardness of our route schedules and how easy it is to use our transit. And right now I don't find it's a very easy situation. Aside from the fact that transit for me is not actually accessible.
I'm just going to make one observation on budget generally when it comes to downloading. And you'll learn this if you haven't already. You get downloaded from the province things that they make decisions on. But we, the taxpayer, don't care whether you make the decision or they make the decision. We will pay for that. So that is actually hiding a reality of the decision-making process. And Phil and I have had this discussion many, many times over the last 10 years. And the average taxpayer, which I have the luxury of being right now, doesn't care about downloading. We simply know that somebody's going to pay for the cost of that downloading, or else the service has to be cut. So I think we hide behind the download. I don't think you're hiding, but I think the province is hiding behind the downloading by pretending it's not their responsibility, even though they created the policy. I don't blame any level of government. This is a new belief, by the way. You guys can decide whether you want to do something with it. Any level of government that makes a decision on a service that has to go in has to be financially responsible for finding the way to pay for it. Don't make a decision and then make me responsible as a city council. And if I make the decision, that's my responsibility to implement. If government could ever get to that point, then you guys at city council would have part-time jobs.
Over to you, Aaron. What do you want to say to that?
I'm glad that you don't mind paying for the taxes. I'm not sure if that's everyone's personal feeling, just based on what I see on the internet. But I am glad that there will be no hard feelings when the budget comes up, because it is an interesting situation when you have a certain amount of the responsibility and all of the blame. And it'll be interesting to see how it pans out when the actual budget comes out.
And thanks for that. I think what's really important is for us to appreciate how multifaceted the budget is. The police budget, the library budget, the budget for social services and housing are all essentially controlled by outside organizations. And yet it comes to us to be passed as part of a comprehensive budget. And sometimes we have very little to zero control over those things. So indeed, I think that your point is very well taken. Just while we're on that note, I will remind people that next week we will be having Scott Stewart, our CAO, speaking here, and he will be here live as well. He will be unpacking this even more. And I think it's worthwhile to appreciate, because folks, I'm going to be like the Grinch that stole Christmas this year. And Aaron, regrettably, is not going to be Cindy Lou Who. We've got a tough job to do. It's not a comfortable job. And I think that Aaron is quite correct. We are going to be put on the hot seat for issues that we cannot control at all. Now, did I see any other questions here? Yes, we got another one from Carl. Just a second.
Sorry, I did have two questions. One is the recent one on the two-thirds decision-making. One is the recent, my second question, sorry, Aaron, is on the two-thirds decision-making. We'll probably get into that. But with Phil, see what your understanding is, if it's the same as his. If a budget is brought forward at the recommendation of staff, and of course, you've indicated that the mayor has already been involved in that and assumedly buys into it. But if council disapproves of that budget by two-thirds, Does the mayor have the power to implement whatever he wants? Or does that two-thirds vote actually put it back into the hands of council?
That's a darn good question. Aaron, what's your thought on that one?
This is my understanding, and please keep in mind that this is as fresh for me as it is for you. So my understanding is that the two-thirds vote would put it back into our hands, but not necessarily all of our control. So I think that it would be bits and pieces that have to be massaged. But to be honest, as this is going to be the first time we're all doing this type of budget, it's going to be, and I think we're all fresh to this process. So I'm waiting for the staff first budget display. And once we've actually had it explained to us from staff, then I'll have a better understanding. But I'm sorry, that's not a very good answer.
Actually, I don't think it's a bad answer at all. It's very similar to mine with one caveat. I don't think it comes back to council. I think it goes back to the mayor. So we can overturn it, but it's back to the mayor to revise it until such time as there is less than two-thirds opposition. It never does become something that is just a 50-50, but it's the two-thirds that's key there. The mayor owns it the fullest bolus. So, Aaron, honestly, I think your point about we're all in this together in knowing and not knowing certain things is quite correct. We just don't know. Do we have any other questions, Tanya? Oh, yes, we do. Ron, here's one right now.
Thanks, Phil. I just wanted to ask, from the point of view of citizen of Guelph, I feel that the way the budget has been set up and what's happened with the provisions that make it a mayor's budget, that in fact, citizen involvement is decreasing, that we end up just feeling discouraged and not capable anymore of engaging in the process itself. And so, I don't know, I just wanted to find out what, as councillors, you feel in terms of public involvement, citizen involvement in that process.
Well, I think that in terms of involvement of crafting the budget, that's kind of where staff and all of the communications and public feedback items that they've been working on throughout the years kind of come into play. So all of our master plans and all of the things that we have for hopes for Guelph and our strategic plan, that all feeds into the budget. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we've got a certain number of things that we have to pay for, right? It's just like with your home, you have to pay for your utilities, you have to pay for the water and everything else. And that's the same with the city, right? So we've got the base level of services and supports that we have to provide. And that's going to be all reflected in the budget. And then we've got the extra stuff that kind of like Phil was saying, there's all of the police boards and thing that I'm on the board of health. So the public health also is going to be a piece of our budget. And these are all the extras, but are also the necessities of life. And just with inflation and everything, there's not too much wiggle room in terms of who gets a say in what when you've got a system that there's not a lot of optionals, unfortunately. And for me, I think quality of life is not optional either. So that puts into place things like the libraries and the sports centers and parks. But I think that the feedback comes in at that master plan and other level when we're kind of choosing what do we want wealth to be like. And then that has to be reflected in the budget.
Absolutely. And I think getting back to Ron's question about citizen participation as well, I'm actually very concerned. I think that this whole budget process can make people very, very cynical about becoming involved. Guelph has always been a community that has been engaged in community affairs. But if it is understood that there is no true democratic authority over things like the budget, I think that we will potentially see that dwindle. And in my opinion, that's not healthy for democracy at all. We have another question, and it's John.
I'm assuming that the staff are drawing on the sources that they always draw on to put together this budget. So that can't really change, I'm assuming. They're just putting forward what they see as being the best budget. What are we really frightened of here? Are we just frightened of undue influence from one man when that budget comes to the fore?
I think that's a really good question. Yes, the staff does put together the budget. And Mayor Guthrie was very aware that this is a real yoke around his neck, that he would assume the responsibility for the budget precisely for what you said. And so he has essentially tried to make it as collegial as possible. And I believe staff has been engaged in that as well. The problem is that also at council, we do have ideologies that do exist. And sometimes those do come to bear on the budget. I don't know if that will come to bear this time or not. I think we're all, this is my own personal feeling, I'd love to hear Aaron's. I think that all 13 of us are hoping that we can get through this as smoothly as possible. But I've heard that there are some people on council that are concerned about things like the operating budget for the new library later on, and are concerned about cost overruns on projects that essentially have already been funded from collection of development charges and other things in the past. So I don't know what the impact will be. And John, I have to say, we will only find out after this budget has been tabled and is the 2024 operating budget for the city. Aaron, any comments on that?
Yeah, like the regular budget itself, without the provincial piece of the development charges that we're going to have to be paying for, that part doesn't really concern me. Like incremental increases, inflation, that was an expected situation. I wasn't expecting it to be a no tax increase here. And if we only had that to deal with, then I would be perfectly happy. But it's the additional piece of the provincial inflation to our budget that kind of concerns me. So it's not the process or that staff haven't done their best. I know that they completely have. So it just worries me when we're reliant on the province to make up part of our budget, and none of that has been communicated to us as to when or how much.
Aaron, with that, I want to thank you for having attended. I'm just giving Tanya her 30-second warning about announcements coming up. Aaron, it's been great working with you and getting to know you over the last year. I'm going to tell you right now, you're no longer a rookie, so you better pull up your socks. You're on your own from now on. I also want to thank Ralph for being here, and in his rookie year, assuming such an incredible responsibility to be the board chair. Similarly, it's great to have Carl back with his history of how we used to do things and how we can still do things. And to all of you, I appreciate all the questions. Hopefully, many of you will be back, and maybe a few more for when Scott Stewart will ask him many candid questions. And I am very confident that Scott will answer candidly, because that is his personality, to be honest and upfront about issues, and also to provide you with the warnings and the understandings. So to all of you today, thank you. And I'm going to pass it over to Tanya to find out what it is we're doing in the next week. Tanya.
Okay, so there is a committee of the whole meeting on Monday, November 6th at 2 p.m. And on the agenda are two items: updating the mayor and council expense and education policy, and redesigning the advisory committees of council. There is a special committee meeting also on Monday, November 6th at 6:30 p.m. The decision report regarding 855 and 927 Victoria Road South is on that agenda. And the next day, on Tuesday, November 7th, is the first meeting with regard to the 2023-2027 multi-year budget. There will be the Baker Street operating budget update and so many more things. The agenda will be available on November 3rd. Have your say. Staff is considering a dark sky bylaw. So if you want to find out about this, there is a Zoom on Thursday, November 9th at 6:30 to 8 p.m. Or you can attend a workshop in person on Tuesday, November the 14th from 10 to 11:30 a.m. Please note that lowering the amount of light pollution in an area has measurable benefits for birds, bugs, bats, plants, and people. There is a survey for the Downtown Heritage Conservation District study. So take that survey. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we will be having CAO Scott Stewart here. He'll talk about Baker Budget and Bill 23. Coming soon, the OR lands, can it be a national park? We will discuss the Indigenous murals found in the former penitentiary, food security, and holiday cheer in the form of books and films. And with that, I believe it's a wrap. Thank you, everybody, for being here today.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in. Music is provided by Jules Germ and podcasts produced by Scotty Hertz. Join us every week at Breezy Breakfast. You can listen to us on CFRU on Mondays at 9 a.m. or on Thursdays at 8 a.m. Join our Zoom meeting or attend in person at Rise and Shine, where Bev, our diner diva, takes our breakfast orders and keeps the coffee flowing. Breezy Breakfast, where the food for thought and topics are as hot as your morning tea.